Our discussion of the 1980s continues with a look at the city of Boston during the 1980s. It's a divided city, and the black perspective is a different one. We're going to talk about it right here on the Monday Locked On Celtics. Millie's, let's go! Rain and Jay's back with the vengeance. Back. All the real Celtics fans in attendance. Ooh. This is the truth like 34. Yeah. It's like walking in the garden when you hear the roars. Crowd goes crazy, most in-depth coverage on the daily, mainly podcast royalty, the content kings. When you talking about the franchise with 17 rings, focus like Danny at the deadline, global with it, got a local feel like the red line, the blue line, the green line, play it in between time. I'ma throw my C's jersey on in the meantime and press play. When the F's done, I can't wait until the next day, trying to stay in tune with the C's, it's the best way. Melly. John Corrales here from MassLive.com, welcoming you back to another week of historical deep dives into the Boston Celtics. We are in the 80s, spending 2 weeks on the 1980s because the 1980s are such a massive shift in the NBA, and the Boston Celtics are front and center in all of that. Last week, if you've missed it, Monday and Tuesday, we had a conversation with Danny Ainge in two parts. Wednesday, Robert Parrish, a re-release of our Robert Parrish interview. And then Thursday and Friday were Tommy Heinsohn in two parts. So you go back, and if you've missed it, listen to those shows. You get a really in-depth, really up-close look from people who were there. A couple of guys who played in that era. And of course, Tommy Heinsohn, who had a front row seat for just about everything that has happened in Celtics history. This week, we're going to continue. We're going to get back onto our kind of regular path. I'm going to sit down again with Mike Dinan and have a conversation that will go from Tuesday through Friday, and we get a little deeper into the timeline. But I wanted to start the week by setting the stage a little bit. Tommy Heinsohn brought it up where he talked about black versus white and how the league was marketing Magic and Larry, Lakers and Celtics, is black versus white. There was a packaging. There was a feeling in around the league and in the city that was kind of like one of the undertones here. Boston had an image. LA had an image. And in all of the research and in watching documentaries and things about Boston versus LA, and this is really where the Boston-LA rivalry takes hold here in the 1980s. The racial element is undeniable, and Boston has a very, very interesting kind of history at this point. It's an interesting part of Boston's history in that moment. So I asked Dart Adams. You can follow him on Twitter at Dart Adams. And he is one of the most knowledgeable people about Boston's history. He grew up in Boston, and he has a firsthand look at the black perspective, how the Celtics were perceived in the black community in Boston, and the conflict that, you know, you've got your home team winning championships. Meanwhile, there is a disdain for that team, and interesting reasons why there's a disdain for that team, considering the team's history. So I decided Dart's the guy to talk to. Dart is the author of Best Damn Hip Hop Writing, The Book of Dart. You can get that at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart. He has a couple of podcasts, Boston Legends, which looks at overlooked Boston basketball figures, inner city basketball figures. So check that out. And he also has his Dart Against Humanity podcast, which returns on May 1st. Dart's the guy to talk to about this kind of stuff. Dart's the guy to follow when it comes to history, when it comes to hip hop, especially. We've had Dart in the show before talking about music in the NBA. It was an awesome conversation. So here now is my conversation with Dart Adams. All right. Welcome back to the podcast, Dart Adams. First of all, how you doing? How you feeling?
I'm good, actually, given the circumstances.
We always have to add that "actually" in there. It's like, hey, I'm actually doing okay.
I'm actually all right.
I'm okay. I'm one of the few lucky ones. That's good. I'm glad to hear that. So I thought you'd be the guy to talk to about a very important element of 1980s Boston Celtics, especially in regards to the rivalry with the Lakers.
So oh, yeah.
The one element here, and Tommy mentioned it in the podcast last week, that in this era of Larry Bird versus Magic Johnson, there is a very strong white guy versus black guy, and people are basically taking a pick based on race. Larry Bird comes here and is the great white hope. Boston, you know, the Celtics are named after, and, you know, the fact that Boston is heavily Irish. And Magic tells a story about coming into Boston for a playoff series.
Seeing, I love this story.
Yeah, and seeing guys with Lakers gear on or hearing people say, hey, go kick their ass. And when he says something to the effect of, oh, it's great that Lakers fans are here, the reply was, no, I just want you to go beat these white boys. So you're a young kid in this era. In the mid-80s, you're what, preteen, teens?
So mid-80s, I'm between the ages of 9 all the way up through like 14, 15.
Very impressionable time in a young boy's life. So you're soaking all of this in. So,
oh, absolutely.
And just for people who may not know, you were like the Boston historian. Like you've got a knowledge of the city unlike anybody else's. So why don't you kind of take me through some of the background here as we're setting up this 80s discussion. I mean, we are we're probably what, 8 years into the busing, that ruling, and the city is very divided. Let's kind of set the scene, because sports is like a reflective of the city, and the city is in kind of turmoil.
Absolutely. Well, the thing is that what people don't understand is that, okay, Larry Bird and Magic Johnson both entered the NBA in the 79-80 season and kind of save it.
Yes.
Pretty much. Right. But what a lot of people really don't understand is that the Celtics teams of the early to mid 80s weren't predominantly white. Right.
Right.
Like, and that's a big thing that people don't understand. The early 80s Celtics teams, I mean, you had at one point Chris Ford was a starter, but Chris Ford lost his job to a black guy, you know? You had Cornbread Maxwell, you know, who's on the team before Larry showed up.
Yep.
And he remains a mainstay. Robert Parrish comes in later. And what people forget is that Robert Parrish was a mainstay. He was scoring 20 points a game, getting 10 rebounds, 1.5 blocks, getting steals and everything, running the court faster than everybody else. And he was a perennial all-star from his time joining the Celtics. But Kevin McHale started on the bench.
Mm-hmm.
So Kevin McHale wasn't a starter. Danny Ainge came later. He was drafted, but he played baseball first, and he comes later. So we have Quinn Buckner that people forget about. You know, we have Tiny Archibald that people forget about. You know, there's Gerald Henderson, who's also on the team. There are other black draftees. So the team, like, I went back and did this. So, like, there's 7 out of 13 players on the team are black. This many players are black. It, when people think of the Boston Celtics, they tend to think of Rick Carlisle, Rick Roby, Greg Kite, before they think of the players that actually played the brunt of minutes were black guys.
Right.
ML Carr. And most people think of ML Carr just as the guy who was waving the towel. ML Carr was a mainstay. He was important coming off the bench.
Mm-hmm.
He was an energy guy. You know?
Yeah.
So when you think about all that, that gets lost. Now, more to your point, how did people feel about the Celtics? When things started to switch over from 85 into 86, the feeling about the Celtics changed, because a lot of the black players ended up leaving. They started drafting guys like Brad Lowhouse. They started bringing in guys like Fred Roberts. We start getting players like Jerry Seasting. We lose Max. Max kind of sacrificed himself. This is something people don't talk about enough, to bring in Bill Walton.
Right.
And all of a sudden, for the 85-86 team.
Yes. Yeah.
So all of a sudden, in one fell swoop, well, so it happens over two seasons, really. That team looks very white and very different. You have Connor Henry, who's also a draftee, the guy who shoots the threes. Mm-hmm. So the team is overwhelmingly white now. And this is the greatest, one of the greatest all-time NBA teams, and the Celtics team. And this is the team that white America really latches onto. And what we also forget is that Michael Jordan, I mentioned Magic Johnson and Larry Bird coming in the NBA in 79-80, but Michael Jordan entering the league in 84-85 was a whole new wave of interest in the league. So eyes are on the league more and more as the Celtics and Lakers come to prominence and Michael Jordan enters the league. So the media coverage of the 85-86 Celtics, they were pretty much shoved down everybody's throat.
You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Boston Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Yeah, that 86 team, well, obviously, you have, like you mentioned, Cedric Maxwell is out because Kevin McHale is being elevated. This actually goes back to like the mid-70s. Now, the mid-70s when the ABA comes in and the ABA merges with the NBA, and like the first NBA finals after that, it's Portland versus Philly. And, you know, Philly has Dr. J and has ABA players, and Portland is the traditional, much more traditional structured NBA team, and, you know, led by Bill Walton. And that is like a flashpoint in basketball, like black versus white. And so from there, it starts to kind of press forward. The black players in the league aren't just black players. There are flashy black players.
Yes.
So not only
they don't play team ball.
Right. So we have to make sure that there's a certain element here that it feels like when we talk about race, it gets difficult and sensitive.
Yeah.
But one element of this is it's fine to have black players. I don't have any problem with the black players. It's these kinds of black players. But these black players coming from the ABA playing more quote-unquote street ball, there's flashy, there's flair, there's creativity. Basketball becomes a vehicle for personal expression, and that sets the groundwork for 90s, where the 90s hip-hop basketball, which we've talked about on the podcast before.
Yeah.
The 80s is this transition period. So when we talk about this particular Boston Celtics team, it stands now in contrast to what you mentioned, where Michael Jordan comes in and he's dunking and he's in dunk contest
with
the gold chains and the sneakers, the custom made sneakers. And like there's now a different, not just the black player versus white player, there's a different brand of black basketball player.
Yeah. And the other part is that, so coming up, when people are seeing this happen, they're starting to gravitate more towards in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, Jamaica Plain. Kids are starting to gravitate more, and people are starting to gravitate more due to the fact that the media, and of course the media, the NBA is trying to pull itself out of its low state. So they're using any means they can to sell the game. And if the Celtics versus Lakers, the lunch pail Boston Irish team versus the flashy black team from LA is selling the league, shit, let's do it.
Yeah.
Now, but it flew in the face of, the fans, the fandom. So what happened is a lot of people from Boston, from all the predominantly black and Latino neighborhoods, started leaning away from the Celtics and they became fans of the Philadelphia 76ers or the Lakers or, you know, another team. Some people picked on, actually would pull for the Milwaukee Bucks. And the thing is that a lot of cats weren't necessarily fans of the other team. They just wanted to see the Celtics get their asses kicked because of the way they were being pushed and marketed and sold. Because they knew that they would hear nothing but praise about the Celtics and the way they play basketball and how they do things the right way.
Right.
And it was very coded. So I think that that's something that's been lost, that people have forgotten about. And yes, I saw it my whole life. Now, me personally, if you don't have Boston across your chest, or or Massachusetts or New England or anything across your chest, I'm not rooting for you.
Right.
So I understood people's trepidation. I understood why people were mad. I understood people pulling for other teams, but I'm not a fan of anybody but the Boston squad. But yeah, absolutely. I was around for that. And the thing is that the kids got it from the adults.
Mm-hmm.
The adults more understood the coding and what things meant because they grew up playing basketball and they heard it their entire lives, playing in the BNBL, playing in the Boston North and South, the City League. Some of them played on the Boston Titans, you know, the South End Squires. So they knew what this all was about when you play, you know, Division I, Division II basketball in the state. And they understood where the media was going.
It feels like, yeah, so you get the reaction to the media thing. It's interesting to hear because this is something, obviously, not being black, I don't have this frame of mind. Decoded language, where now I look at those 80s Celtics and I think from a purely basketball perspective, yeah, they did play basketball the right way. And so I want to know, like, how do you have a conversation like that where I sit there and say they did play basketball the right way without it being,
oh, they absolutely did.
Right. Without it being the coded part, like, explain the difference for people who don't understand.
Sure. All right. So there are levels, there are layers to it, right? Now sharing the ball, moving the ball, moving without the ball, finding your teammates, playing team defense, sacrificing of yourself, hustling, all these things that are hallmarks of a great team and great team basketball. Now, I'd like to remind everybody that in the inner city in Boston, as flashy and like the guy who's credited with introducing the crossover to everybody is Charlie Scott. But Charlie Scott learned it from two guys from Roxbury when he went to school in Lauenburg Institute in South Carolina. Those guys were Spider Bennett and Jimmy Walker. So let's just put that out there.
Mm-hmm.
This is why I have you on Rucker,
for history like that.
Yes. While the New York had the Rucker, Roxbury had their own version of the Rucker, and Roxbury ran for years, and Celtics and pros from all over would come down and play and get killed by some of the best. Now, that being said, when you watched the game or you heard commentators talk about the game, they would say things, code words, that they meant for the white players versus the black players. And if the black players did something similar to what the white players did, the things that they valued, they would use a different descriptor as opposed to the same one they did for the white player. And the crazy thing is that I need to put this out there. The Los Angeles Lakers won 5 titles in the 80s. Why? Because they played Celtics basketball better than the Celtics did. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Another reason why is because the Lakers, God bless them, could actually attract free agent talent. Now, why could they attract free agent talent? Because these players, who were predominantly usually black, would always opt to play with the Lakers as opposed to the Celtics.
Mm-hmm.
And another piece of it that people don't talk about is that the Celtics lost out on a lot of young players because Casey Jones did not like playing young players.
Right. Right. He and Tommy touched on that. That Casey was not a talent developer. He had his guys. And I mean, look, what talent are you really going to develop when you've got Larry, Kevin,
exactly.
You know, Chief? I mean, that wasn't a place for young players to come along and learn and grow. That was a place for like, who can we get to plug in and say, all right, we need a shooter. Well, who's the best shooter we can find out there? Then you try to get a Jerry Seichting or somebody else or, you know, Carlisle or whatever. So the one thing that has always stood out about Larry Bird. Now, Larry Bird is obviously like the face of the franchise.
Yes.
And so when you think of the pushbacks against Larry Bird, like Isaiah Thomas saying that if Larry Bird was a black player, he'd just be another good player. If we're looking at this from a racial perspective, the Celtics as a predominantly white team at their peak, and Larry Bird's the face of it, but Larry Bird is the one guy who always just pushed back against that stuff.
Oh yeah.
And has, you know, from the beginning, like he never, ever, ever got caught up in it. And even when Isaiah said that, his reaction was, look, I don't care what he says. I don't care. That's not that he can say what he can say. Like he never once participated even remotely in all of that. So in the, go ahead.
And a big reason for that is that if anybody knows about Larry Bird and studies Larry Bird, Larry wanted to play against the best competition. And in Indiana, that meant Larry Bird would seek out and play against black players. And his game was tailored, if you notice, for him to succeed playing against players who might be faster than him, might be able to jump higher than him. But he was going to do things that made him matter on the court, regardless of who his competition was. Mm-hmm. And he seeked out the challenge. So people tend to think that Larry Bird was the great white hope who somehow managed to play well against, you know, the best players. But it's because he worked at it and he sought out the best players. So if you put a white guy to guard Larry, he saw it as like you were disrespecting him. Okay. So Larry Bird would talk smack to everybody. But the other part is that when that was said by Isaiah Thomas, Larry understood exactly what he meant by it. Mm-hmm. So he was like, we need to have a press conference. We need to air this out. This does not matter to me. You guys don't need to be worked up over it because I know exactly what he meant. And I understand how the NBA is trying to sell this game and try to market this game in order to, you know, appeal to the most people possible. The bottom line is what we do on the court. That's why he wanted that squashed immediately. But yes, were there hard feelings between him and Isaiah that ultimately led to Isaiah not being on the Dream Team? But Larry and Michael Jordan and other players on the Dream Team were instrumental in saying we don't want Isaiah on the team. And it all came down to Michael Jordan. But it was for reasons like that. But it was all in competition because people tend to forget in terms of Isaiah. Isaiah grew up in the Midwest playing against McHale. So McHale called him Zeke because that's what they called him in all the AAU games and everywhere that they went and everywhere they played. So and also back in those days, how everybody knows each other now. And they're all friends and buddy-buddy coming up from being kids right. All up through AAU in college. That was not the case back in the 80s, you know? So it was a lot more confrontational. There was hatred on the court. So in that context, it made sense. But all Larry cared about was playing the game and winning, playing the best people. So he wasn't going to feed into anything else other than that.
Follow us on our social channels at LO Celtics on Twitter and at Locked On Celtics on Instagram. In the Boston Black community, there's this pushback now that you're saying against the way the media is portraying everything. Meanwhile, there's a Boston team, and civic pride crosses all boundaries. It crosses a lot when it comes to sports. Everybody seems to come together when it comes to sports. So is there conflict? Like you're different, but you're describing people who said we want the Celtics to get their ass kicked, but you know Larry's Larry and Larry's flashing. He's playing that kind of basketball, and he never seems to care. What's the conflict in? At a time where the Celtics are a Boston team winning championships, and meanwhile there's this kind of distaste for how the team is being portrayed or marketed.
Yeah, well, a lot of it has to do with the fact that if the Celtics won a game, and again, for those of you that don't live in Boston, or those of you that do, you have to remember back in the 80s how things were. The best sports section, in my opinion, was the Boston Globe. But you also had some, you know, some great people writing at the Boston Herald, right? Now, what the Celtics used to do, and I was told this by Celtics, when the Celtics won a game, they would go get the Globe and the Herald, and they would see whose pictures appeared in the paper when they won a game. If they lost the game, they would have wagers on whose pictures appeared in the paper. Sometimes it would go to the paper and it would be a picture of Robert Parrish in a loss, or Dennis Johnson in a loss, or Darren Day in a loss. But when they won, it was Larry. It was Kevin. You know, it might be Danny Ainge. You know, it might be a shot of Jerry Seasting making a layup or something. Mm-hmm. And that was a game that they played within themselves. So just to give you an idea. But even people who like wanted to see the Celtics lose, they were not going to deny themselves that Larry was bad, that he was a bad man, or that Kevin McHale would kill everybody in the post. It was just the fact that when you watched a Celtics game or a Celtics versus Lakers game, the Lakers could be doing all the same things the Celtics were doing, but they necessarily weren't getting the same calls or respect as the Celtics were in terms of the commentary or in terms of the way things were framed. And that was a huge issue. And then again, you know, when you looked at when the Celtics did have, you know, Cedric Maxwell be the MVP of the 1981 team, it was almost like people were upset that it wasn't Larry as opposed to celebrating the fact it was Max.
So Maxwell is pretty strongly he has spoken pretty strongly about a lot of the stuff that happened. What was the feeling that you got at the time where he's now kind of run out of Boston? He gets hurt, he hurts his knee. There's this feeling that he's not working hard enough. He gets traded for Walton, and he gets traded so Kevin McHale can be elevated. Mm-hmm. So there's this, I think, three-pronged thing.
Absolutely.
Max takes the fall, McHale gets elevated, and Walton comes in. So in a community, and you alluded to this earlier, that is kind of watching all of this, What's the perspective? Like, what's this feeling like? Like, Max has run out of town.
Yeah, but the other part is that we knew it was coming. Like, you couldn't keep Kevin McHale on the bench forever. Kevin McHale was like six man runner up for what, 3 years straight or something crazy like that.
Yeah,
and he was young.
Yeah, he won it a couple years in a row, I think.
Yeah, so it was clear Kevin McHale's going to take that power forward spot. And it was just a matter of time and how they were going to get Max out of there. Because Max is either going to go to the bench or he was going to get traded. But what happens is Max traded for a broken guy who a lot of people thought had nothing left in the tank. However, that trade, and this is what made it worse, that trade worked out incredibly well for the Celtics.
Yeah.
You get Bill Walton, who's a tremendous passer, an amazing rebounder given his age. If you go back and you look at the stats, you see what his rebound percentage was. It's insane if you watch the games. And then you watch his ball awareness and the way he handled the ball and he passed. So Larry Bird is a tremendous passer, but also he's an amazing interior passer. All right?
Yep.
And then you have Bill Walton, who has the same type of court awareness. But when you take Bill Walton, Larry Bird, and Robert Parrish, who are incredible outlet passers and interior passers and can knock down shots from anywhere within 18 to 20 feet, it's unstoppable. So people saw, oh, they got rid of Max and it worked out better for the team. And you brought in another white guy and we knew he was going to be gone. And look at McHale. Now McHale scoring 25, 26, 28 a night. You know, it all worked out perfectly. So that is a thorn in the side. It hurts, but we all knew it was coming. It made the Celtics better, but at what cost? But Max didn't but if you look at Max's career from then on, you know, it was the right play to make for the franchise and for the team. But in terms of the city and in terms of the people who live here, it hurt. It still hurt regardless, because again, we knew it was coming. It was inevitable. It was just how it was going to happen.
Yeah. See, this is really interesting because it seems like there's a feeling like, okay, yeah, we get it. This is good. This is fine. Like you can't deny Larry's great. McHale's great. That trade worked. All of this worked. But it's the outside stuff that's really the causing the reaction.
And here's the other piece of it that people don't really understand. So Dennis Johnson, all-time great defensive player, man played almost a full season with a broken hand and was still either first or second team all defensive. Okay?
Yep.
You have Robert Parrish, who is easily one of the all-time great centers, but he doesn't score as much as everybody else. He doesn't rebound and block shots as much because he's deferring to Kevin McHale in the post. Then you have the fact that the Boston Celtics were led by a black coach, Casey Jones. And for some odd reason, people tend to forget that key matchup. So we're looking at Celtics versus Lakers, Pat Riley versus Casey Jones. The Celtics had a black coach. They won championships with a black coach. The Celtics have won more championships with black coaches and had more black coaches and had them first than any NBA franchise. But somehow that got overlooked. That seed that just made some people so pissed off. You know, like, how can you overlook that if you're going to look at the racial component of everything? And then the other part is that people don't talk about this nearly enough. At the time these games were being played, LA was 10% black.
Okay.
Boston was between 20 and 25% black. But somehow, through the magic of marketing and spin, it's this overwhelmingly white city versus this overwhelmingly black city. But also, it's a clash of cultures. You're well aware that there was a podcast done that talks about the Celtics and My Secret, 1985, their single, and their record label, MCA, has them shoot it at the Forum with the Lakers, even though they're Roxbury kids who are all Celtics fans.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that was another knife that people don't talk about, because it's like, look, you got kids from Boston and they're not even rocking with the Celtics. You know?
Right.
And their label was like, look, we're based in LA. nobody wants to see New Edition playing with the Celtics besides New Edition and the Boston Celtics, you know? So that was another thing. So people tend to bring that up in the discussion too, but there were all these different things going on in that era that, you know, really just, it just, like, even when I think about it to this day, it just leaves a taste in my mouth, you know?
Yeah. Well, so this is the reason I want to have this discussion is because a lot of people don't understand from the black community in Boston from that perspective. And in the, again, from the, like I said at the top, we're in an era where the busing, we're probably, when Larry Bird gets to the league, the worst of the busing was only like 3 years, like the worst of the protests was only like 3 years prior. So it's still all fairly fresh. It's still happening. The perception is the problem.
Absolutely.
And so,
because when people think of Boston to this day, they pull up images of busing in 76 and 77. And I'm like, this is not even the city anymore.
Right. So the Boston now is much different than Boston in the 70s and 80s and, you know, the,
not even the 90s.
And yeah. So the demographics have changed, although we could have an entirely separate discussion about the way that, you know, the neighborhoods are still, there's still segregation, you know, you know, the way the neighborhoods are.
Yeah. It's just a different kind of segregation.
Yeah. So, but it feels like, so sports is an escape, but it feels like from a black perspective, you don't get to have that escape. You don't get to have that same escape in the 80s because of the way you can't even watch basketball and enjoy it and love the fact that your home team is playing well and winning championships because the rest of the way it's being packaged is like thrown in your face in a way.
It's constant. So everybody in Boston pretty much has an idea of what the experience like was being a Boston sports fan. Not entirely the same for everyone. Being a Boston Red Sox fan, my experience was different than the average Boston Red Sox fan. Being a kid in the 80s watching the Boston Celtics, sure, we would go turn on the TV to 56 or 25 or whatever channel was covering the Celtics, 38, SBK, whoever channel was covering the Celtics at the time. We would turn on the radio and we would turn down the television and we would listen to Johnny Most. Mm-hmm. Sure. But when it was a national broadcast and we were listening to this is the NBA on CBS, you know, or when we were watching Big East basketball or something to that occasion, something like that, we would watch basketball and we would hear the way they would describe different players. And this continued on throughout the 90s. This is the reason why, and people don't understand this, this is the reason why guys like the guy at Duke,
who?
Christian Laettner, was hated, you know?
Yes.
This is why Bobby Hurley was on a level that tested, but we didn't hate him anywhere near as much as we hated Christian Laettner because of all the praise heaped on him. It's the reason guys like Steve Wojciechowski, the scrappy son of a longshoreman who's heady and plays with his heart, you know, gets all the accolades and everything, even though he has no shot of going to the NBA. Mm-hmm. But if you had a black player who hustled as much as he did, took as many charges, they would not get anywhere near the amount of love or coverage that Steve Wojciechowski gets. And I need to stress this. That's one of the reasons why it is so important that a player like Marcus Smart is so beloved in Boston. Marcus Smart's shooting percentage may not be what you want it to be, but that man does nothing but play winning basketball. And if you want to win the hearts and minds of Celtics fans, that's what you have to do. The Celtics gave him a big contract because he does just that. Mm-hmm. I've had people from every fandom imaginable in NBA like, why do you guys love this guy so much? Look at his shooting percentages. Look at this. Look at that. Look at him flop. And I was like, but look at what he does on the court. I could send you a uppercut of him winning game after game after game after game after game for the Celtics. Now, if we go back to the 70s, 80s, and 90s, it's rare that a player like Marcus Smart would be beloved by those same people that he preys on, the heady, scrappy, smart player, you know? Mm-hmm. Wow. And the thing is that there was a piece done on Real Sports, I believe in like the late 90s or the early zeros, about that, like the preconceptions of players of different races and how the players used to make jokes about it. Like, wow, that was a heady play there. Like, wow, you have a high basketball IQ. You know, you're a coach on the court. You know, you're a high riser. You know, that was really athletic. Mm-hmm. That was cerebral. And the thing is that, again, like, it took players like Bill Russell to get recognized as being cerebral and also athletic.
Right.
No, that's not this. That wasn't extended to players like Pat Riley. I mean, not Pat Riley, Pat Ewing when he was young. You know, right. That wasn't extended to guys like Akeem Olajuwon when he was at Houston. It came later.
So the perception. So when you're talking about the language, you're talking about black players are being called athletic, things that involve physical ability.
Speed, while, yes.
While white players are being called intelligent, their brains.
Yes.
They're being praised for their brains, and black players are being praised for their bodies, which brings back long-standing prejudices and is part of a centuries-long style of coded language.
Absolutely.
So
I've never seen... I can't tell you, honestly, I can't tell you a player that was white between 1979 and 1999 that was described as having an NBA body.
Mm-hmm.
I can't name one.
Yeah.
I can name some I saw, but I can't name one that I personally heard it come out of the mouth of a commentator. My friends, hey, look at that kid. Wow, he has an NBA-ready body already.
Yeah.
That kid jumps out the gym talking about, you know, Rex Chapman.
Yeah.
That's an athletic play. Or when a white player did something that was athletic, the way they said it or their response to it was they're blown away it happened.
Yeah. Right.
Versus had it been somebody else.
Right.
So yeah, absolutely.
This is so. I want it to be clear how, because when we have discussions like this, which I really do think are important, because there are going to be people listening, and maybe some people are going to hate this podcast, and you know, I'm sorry, but there are people who don't quite understand like why certain things matter, and words that are generally harmless. Like none of these words that are used to describe any of the black players are slurs or negative or anything. But mm-hmm. It's what I think is really important for people to understand is they don't have to be to reinforce a stereotype that
absolutely
they and for the black community versus, I mean, I don't like to say white community, black community very, but it's shorthand for, you know, the general feeling. that you constantly are bombarded with this imagery, this descriptor, this thing, and it goes back to the beginning where all you are is a piece of meat, and that's how you're treated. And the not adding how intelligent players were, like Bill Russell, you're right, is like one of the first black players that is lauded for that. When we were doing the 60s version of the historical deep dive, I talked about the Lakers coach. Was it the Lakers coach or the Philly coach? I forget. I don't have it right in front of me. Who said, we could beat the Celtics, but once you put Bill Russell on there, he it's the mind games. Everybody's worried about him. And so, but you don't hear the players described that way. So just to reinforce your point, by not doing so, it drives home this kind of almost like subliminal, like, well, the white players are the smart ones and they get things done. And the black players are just there to run fast and jump high and dunk the ball.
Yeah. And it really switches when we get to a stretch of the NBA where American-born white guys are not entering the league at a high rate at all.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is European players end up being brought into the NBA. And I remember I wrote a piece about this. I was a basketball writer first in the early zeros online. And I remember writing a piece about this, talking about how people said that the NBA was going to be this percentage of European players by this year. And I challenged them on it. I was like, give it 5 years from this draft and let's see what the percentage is at, because I can tell you that more of the high school players who are American born are going to end up being superstars and NBA starters. And maybe some bench players for 5 to 8 years than the European players they're bringing in, the first crop at least, because I understand basketball. It turns out, you fast forward 5, 10 years, I was absolutely right. But then you have to go back and look at why these people made these predictions. It was more so because they felt it needed to happen in order to keep NBA fandom up. Because they felt that players weren't going to be as interested in the league if they didn't see themselves on the court in some form or fashion.
So the representation is a big element in all of this, because you go back to the 80s, and you know, you can see these documentaries where you see white Celtics fans talking about, like, yeah, we want to see a white guy on there do well because that's what we want to see. But at the same time, from a black perspective, you want to see the black point guard leading the team. And to your earlier point, this is the interesting kind of presentation of it, because the Celtics did have a black point guard.
Yes.
They specifically traded for this guy, and he's like the final piece to all of this. You have a black head coach, a black point guard, and still the presentation is what it was.
Yes.
And the Celtics, for all of their history, first black head coach, first black player drafted, first all black starting five, all of these things, that could have been something that celebrated another black head coach winning a championship, but it really wasn't.
No, absolutely not.
So,
like, when I think about the 80s Celtics, like, in the city, if you didn't play team basketball or share the ball, violence might happen to you, you know? Mm-hmm. Because that's how basketball's meant to be played. Even in street ball, you're crossing somebody over. You probably can't cross somebody over 12 times, because at some point you have to get to the hoop and shoot. And the other thing was, back in the days, if you cross somebody up and you shot and you missed, the play wasn't finished. People didn't celebrate if you didn't finish the play. So even in the changes in basketball and how people perceived it, it was, we still in Boston followed this, these guidelines of this is how the game's meant to be played. The problem is that the perception from certain people was that, oh, you're not playing it the right way, even though we're like, no, we absolutely are. It just looks somewhat different than what you're used to. I bring it back to the Lakers. You watch the Lakers run a fast break. The thing that Red Auerbach stressed was a perfect fast break is when you run up and down the court and without dribbling the basketball. It's just pass, 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 finish, or pass, pass, finish, or pass, finish. The Lakers were doing this in the 80s better than anybody. And the reason was is because they had younger legs and they had deeper teams. When I watch the Boston Celtics and the Lakers play basketball, I throw all the coded language out. I throw all the framing out. And I just watch two amazing basketball teams play basketball the way it was meant to be played. You know?
Yep.
But again, that's not what everyone else sees.
Well, I mean, I agree. First of all, the fast break stuff was... When you can get the ball up the floor without dribbling, it's just beautiful to watch.
And really take it off the basket after a made basket.
Yes. Oh, that's Tommy Heinsohn's big thing. Tommy's like, pull the ball out of the net and get the ball up the floor. Which it's interesting that, you know, he thinks the 60 Celtics would have beaten the 80 Celtics.
I understand the premise behind it. But in execution, I'm not 100% sure what happened. But I understand why he thinks it.
Oh, totally. I mean, look, he's – what's he going to say?
Exactly.
What the hell is he going to say?
He played on those teams and he coached the teams afterwards. What else is he going to say?
I mean, he's got a, you know, a bucket full of rings. He's won championships. He was on the most dynastic team in NBA history.
I will admit one thing that he was right about. His Celtics were way deeper than the 80s Celtics.
Well, yeah, but they also had eight teams in the NBA back then.
Yeah, so they could allow for it to be. Right. But the thing, when we look back at the 80s Celtics, right? When you look at that roster, like, and also another thing that I haven't discussed yet is certain talented black players in the within a Celtics organization just didn't last. Darren Day ended up going to Europe. As opposed to staying with the Celtics because they wouldn't pay him.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
Which a lot of people don't talk about ever.
Right. Nobody talks about
Darren
Another
thing
Day.
After that, no one talks about Darren Day. Another thing people don't talk about is when they brought in Derek Smith and how Larry was pissed off that they didn't make it a point to keep Derek Smith on the squad. They didn't do everything they could to keep Derek Smith playing. He even wrote about it in his autobiography. You know, that's another point of contention. When you look at how guys like Brian, like how Brian ended up leaving the team, you know, in order to make up for the mistake that he made in his oversight, you know, Auerbach said that he was playing defense like. People were going through him like a sieve, but then he goes to Orlando and he's playing some of the best basketball of his career. So everybody's looking back at the Celtics organization like, why'd you let that guy go?
Right.
You know? And when you look at the draft picks, if you go through, like, it's hard to defend when you go through the 80s draft picks. They drafted a lot of guys from BYU.
They did. You know? They had Ainge, they had Greg Kite, they had Jerry Seasting. I always get tripped up on the Seasting name. It's a hard name to say. But, yeah. And then they brought in Mark Akers from Oral Roberts, too, which is is basically another
Mark
BYU.
Akers. Mark Number Akers. 42.
Yeah. Mark Akers, Brad Lowhouse. They didn't do themselves any favors with the perceptions.
Michael Young.
Right. I mean, they – but, you know, they also – you know, they it wasn't just that. I mean, they – brought in Reggie Lewis. They brought in Len Bias. Their best players were supposed to be, you know, the next generation was Reggie Lewis and Len Bias. But, you know.
Well, that's a key point, too. Everything changes if Len Bias lives.
Oh, everything. Everything.
Len Bias lives. He's in the starting six. He's the sixth man easily, right? He's going to move into the starting lineup. Now, here's what people don't realize the most, man. The Celtics were going to draft Reggie Lewis regardless. 87. You know, whether they had picked 22 or 23, they were going to pick Reggie Lewis. You know, people like to say that the reason the Celtics picked Reggie Lewis is because he slid, because he had a bad Portsmouth Invitational Tournament, because he was injured or what have you. But nobody else was going to draft Reggie Lewis in the first round but Boston. And Boston, whether they picked 22nd or 23rd, they were going to draft Reggie Lewis. And what would have happened is you would have had Reggie Lewis and you would have had Lynn Bias in that beginning 6-8-man rotation. And there's no doubt in my mind that those guys would have moved up the same way that they gave spots to eventually gave spots to Ainge, and this way that they gave a spot to Kevin McHale.
Yeah.
There's no doubt in my mind that that would have happened. And if you have those guys in the league at the same time as a young Michael Jordan and Pippen and the Pistons, and you have the Bucks on the other side, then you have the Lakers. So much changes in the NBA between 1987 and 1993 if Lynn Bias lives.
I mean, it's very, there's a very strong case to be made that the Celtics continue winning, and you know, not only that, you have no Rick Pitino, probably. Like, the entire course of Celtics history changes. Paul Pierce does not become a Celtic. Like, everything after that is a ripple effect, because you have two spectacular players, you know, one and two, that could play off of one another. Obviously, we never get to see Len Bias play in the NBA, so we don't know how it would have worked out for sure. But, I mean, it's a pretty strong consensus that he was going to be pretty special. Everybody who talks about him has that feeling.
Absolutely.
But anyway, so the perception of the Celtics is one thing. The reality of the Celtics is kind of another. There's a brief period there where the reality and the perception kind of like do a little dance in the mid to late 80s. You're like, all right, we're, you know, but really, honestly, that's like the only time that it, this perception of Boston as this white team in a white city is really true. Like, other than in the 60s when the entire league was struggling to integrate, but the Celtics,
and even then the Celtics had a bunch of black guys on the team.
Right. I mean, they picked in that 57 draft, they got Casey Jones and Bill Russell. Obviously Bill Russell is the key player, but Casey Jones is a very important perimeter defender in Celtics history. The Celtics, Sam Jones is an incredibly important player in that time. There are a lot of really important players. JoJo White, they pick up JoJo White. Like, you just go through all of these in the Celtics, aside from, you know, whatever their perception is, their history is kind of different, progressive in a lot of ways.
Absolutely.
Which is just interesting. And there's that, because the NBA needed to be saved, because black versus white was a strong selling point.
Oh, absolutely.
That is the perception that stuck with the Celtics kind of now forever. And so I guess I'll end it on this. From your perspective as a black Bostonian, you have a franchise here that it feels like, for me on the outside, you should be proud of.
Absolutely. The I mean, when you think about it.
Yeah.
But when you think about it, before that stretch where the team is pretty much predominantly white and sold as that, and it's the greatest NBA team ever, the team is predominantly black. After that era is over, when you have Larry Bird and Kevin McHale and Robert Parrish leaving and them and everybody going to the bench, you bring in a bunch of young players. Who are these young players? You got Reggie Lewis. You got Kevin Gamble. You have Brian Shaw. You have D. Brown. You have Rick Fox. I'm up to five. You know, young black guys. And then who are the point guards? Sherman Douglas and Johnny and Bags, you know?
Yep.
That's seven.
I love Sherm.
And so we look at those teams that were winning 54, 55, 56 games a year, but getting killed by the Cleveland Cavaliers in the playoffs because of height, you know, in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Nobody had anything to say about those teams. And it was weird because during those years, nobody is saying these things about the Celtics. They're Celtics fans again. They're wearing the Celtics gear in the hood. You know, everybody has their Celtics hats on. They got their mm-hmm. Celtics starter caps. You know, they got their jackets. They don't have the satin ones anymore. Thank God. It's the starter era. You know all about the shiny satin green ones.
Oh, I know all about
this. Yep. So, you know, the perception has changed and everything. But no one ever talks about that. How all these people in the hood who are like, we want to see the Celtics lose are – bam. All right. We're Celtics fans again. You know, yeah. It's not an issue, but that era it was, and it was mainly because of how they were marketed, how they were sold, and how the media was pushing this, you know, this, agenda towards selling the Celtics. And that's what turned people off. Because again, when it comes to your team and your hometown, that kind of overrides a lot. But there's only so much you could take, you know. I mean, look at black fans and their relationship with like the Patriots going back and forth. You know, mm-hmm. we love the Patriots, but we hate a lot of the stuff that they do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right. So it's always that slope. You know, I mean, that's always going to be with sports. It's why I stopped listening to sports radio because of the nature of wording and the coded language and some of the fandom. It's also why I have a contentious relationship with Barstool, you know, for the same mm-hmm. thing. I love the sports, but I don't necessarily love every aspect of the fandom, you know?
Right. Well, this is really interesting. And I'm glad you had we took this time to have this conversation because it's the way things are packaged is important. And to hear your perspective on it, I think it's important for people to know and understand like the language, the packaging, the perception, the way it's pushed, the way it was sold, how all of that stuff is impactful on ways that if you're not black, if you're not in Boston at that time, you just don't understand. That experience is just a different life than a lot of people lead. A lot of people who listen to this podcast live a different life. So I'm glad that you were able to take an hour here to help shine a light on that and explain what the feeling was. So
no problem. That's what I'm here for.
Thank you very much, sir. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Big thanks to Dart for coming on to the show. Again, he is the author of Best Damn Hip Hop Writing, The Book of Dart, which is available right now for purchase at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Walmart. You can also listen to one of his podcasts. He has the Boston Legends podcast, which is a look at overlooked basketball figures in Boston history, the city of Boston, inner city basketball figures. Very interesting podcast there. And the Dart Against Humanity podcast, where he just talks about whatever he wants to talk about. That comes back on May 1st. Dart, good dude, good follow, a person that really very knowledgeable about the city, very knowledgeable about hip hop, culture, all of it. So thanks to him, and make sure you give him a follow at Dart Adams on Twitter. Thanks to you for hopefully enjoying this podcast and continuing to follow this podcast. This one was, you know, a little bit different. I hope you enjoyed this because I think this is an important element. This is a big deal, I think, for people to kind of know. The sports encompasses the city. It's part of the city. And if the city is having these conflicts within it, that shows up in the teams, in the fandom. So I thought this was an important podcast when we're talking about the 1980s to kind of get into. So we're going to continue again this week with the 1980s, and then next week, the 90s, and we keep marching on. We're going to bring it right up to 2020. We're going to continue all the way through. So subscribe if you haven't subscribed. And if you have, please share the podcast, tell your friends, tell everybody that they should be listening to the Locked On Celtics podcast here on the Locked On Podcast Network.